everyone, Joan Sodkin here, and welcome to The Prosperity Show, where we explore the inner path to business and financial success, personal fulfillment, and peace of mind. And one of the things that fascinates me is how people get to be who they become. It's, to me, that's the ultimate fascination, is we all have different stories, and how we respond to the first part of our life affects the second part of our life and the third and fourth parts of our lives. And every story is so different. And that's one of the things that fascinates me. So after doing a series of solo episodes, I'm now going to do occasional interviews as well. And today's is with someone who I met a while ago who I find really interesting. So let's get to the interview. My guest today is author and CEO Marty Strong. Marty spent 20 years in the Navy's elite SEAL teams, learning effective leadership skills and mastering the art of turning vision into actionable strategy. After his service, he spent 7 years as a financial advisor and portfolio manager with UBS before moving on to become a C-suite executive. Marty's new book, Be Nimble, is set for release in the fall of 2021. And before I get to Marty, let me just say that he and I had a conversation the other day, and he taught me all about SEAL training, which it's like from another world that I lived in. I mean, people I knew never went into the service, let alone the SEALs. And it's amazing training that anyone who survives it has a mindset and abilities that it seems to me very few people have. So I'm interested in finding out from Marty how that training has translated into what he does now as an executive and advisor. I mean, he's done so many things. So, Marty, welcome to the Prosperity Show.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us just briefly why you decided to be a Navy SEAL.
Okay. Well, the story that was on the back of my retirement brochure covered that answer, and it was pretty simple. I was sent to SEAL training through a mistake of orders. I went into the Navy at 17 to become a radar operator like my father was during the Korean War. I went through boot camp, and then I went to radar air traffic control school. And when I graduated, they handed me a packet and they read off your orders. And it said, report no later than 0730 tomorrow morning to Coronado, California, underwater demolition SEAL training. I didn't know what the words meant. I didn't understand what was going on. I was able to patch it together later. And I ended up going in to be observed for a swim competition during boot camp. And I was timed, but what the event was in the pool was the SEAL screening test. And whoever took me over there just told me to do whatever this gentleman tells you to do. I'm just going to watch you for the swim portion. When he's done with you, come back to the boot camp company. And that's it. And when we were done, there was about 60 people swimming when I got dropped off in the pool. And we did pull-ups and push-ups after the swim, and we went for a mile and a half run in the dark by that time. But by the time that the run happened, there was only about 7 of us. And when the run was over, there was only 3 of us. And they asked us to fill out a form and then go back to your boot camp company. Didn't put the two together, but that was the SEAL training test I passed. And so somehow that got in front in the Navy system that was my next set of orders after radar school. And when I got there, a little 5'3" Vietnam guy with 10 rows of ribbons on his chest convinced me to stay and try it.
I'm really into synchronicity and the things that happen coincidentally that aren't really coincidence. And obviously you were meant to do what you did and get the training that you got and spend 20 years in the service. So when people don't make it, Yeah, I mean, it's such a difficult training, and there's lots of information online. I saw that there are a lot of places where you can find out exactly what that training is. What is it that makes it so people don't make it? Even the test that you just described with the pool, what is it that make it so people don't make it?
So the SEALs and the Green Berets were both created by John F. Kennedy in 1962. Both organizations kind of struggled in the beginning to try to define themselves and to figure out what was the best way to recruit people for these new units for the new war in Vietnam. It was a jungle war, so they were kind of aiming towards things that they thought would make sense, mostly survivability, you know, physical toughness, those kinds of things. So the SEAL training course started out being screening for physical toughness. Once the SEALs started going into war, going to Vietnam, and they were going in for 60 days, 60 to 90 days, coming back for 30 to 60 days and going right back in again. So they were doing multiple rotational combat tours. Once they started getting a little bit of the actual mission and experience under their belt, they started coming back and saying, you know, what we really need is people that can handle mental stress. We need people that can handle the physiological stress that can cause psychological trauma or indecision or fatigue that leads to bad decisions, et cetera. And so what they did is they modified the screening test, and the Green Berets kind of did the same thing around the same time. So from around 1965 to 66, the blend was it's physically demanding, but the point of the physical effort is to create a psychological dilemma for the individual student, where they have to make a choice whether they want to continue, which is the same kind of choice you have if you're trying to climb a mountain with a pack on your back or go through a steamy jungle and, you know, and you're really tired. It's a mission completion kind of requirement. It's a combination of physical and psychological. And most SEALs would tell you, if you weighed it, it'd be about 40% physical capability and 60% psychological capability. I was only 125 pounds when I went in, 17 years old. There were people that were much bigger, stronger, faster, all those things. And at the end of 6 months, the 126 people I started with ended up with 13 original graduates, and I was one of them. So I kind of subscribed to that 60-40 mix, mostly mental. So the attrition, which is 75% per class, it's been that way nonstop, pretty much since the mid-60s, no matter what they tweak or try to do. The attrition is probably about 90% people deciding to just drop out of the course. It's a volunteer course to get in, and you can drop on request at any time. There's a ceremony where you have to go up to a big brass Navy bell and ring the bell three times to signify that you've quit. It's a social symbol and event that it was hoped to be a deterrent, because you have to do it kind of in front of everybody. And it works for a lot of people. They'd rather just keep going instead of getting up there in front of their friends and ring the bell. But, you know, that's 90% decide, this isn't for me. The other 10% either get injured or there's academic issues. Some have problems with safety, and they get a couple of shots. But if they do something that's repeat, kind of lack of judgment, nobody wants them around demolitions or, you know, being underwater or the diving rig on your back. So really, like most courses are the other way around. It's mostly 90% academic and skills and competency and things like that. And maybe 10% something else like tenacity, but it's the flip for buds. So that's why most people quit. That's about the percentages of how many people quit for the reasons they quit. And that's kind of what the course is designed to try to accomplish.
As you were saying that, I remember the statistic that 80% of small business owners don't make it, that within 5 years, 80% of small businesses close. And I think that we're talking about similar mental strengths, tenacity and resilience and the willingness to go through whatever you have to go through. So do you see that as a similarity?
I do. And that Pareto thing, it's weird how that keeps popping up all the time and is applicable, that 80-20 rule. So the tenacity part, I mean, if you're a business owner, you're going to start a small restaurant. It's obviously not about the physical challenges of running or staying awake and carrying a load on your back. But the psychological component is exactly the same. And I think it probably is the same kind of nexus of decision between discomfort, the discomfort that comes from risk, all kinds of forms of risk, every category you can think of, financial risk, personal risk, physical risk, risk of your self-esteem or your public image. All those things are conspiring to try to convince you, that little voice in your head is trying to convince you, maybe this isn't the right thing to do. Now, then you start to have these odds, right? You start to have people that, because people that quit that are tenacious, they may quit in a restaurant business and they pop up someplace else and they're an Uber driver. Right. I mean, they don't quit. They just refocus.
Right. You know, and I mean, I've been in business for myself forever, other than when I sold Great Books of the Western World door-to-door cold canvassing, which many people didn't survive. And I've had to do some pretty fancy dancing along the way because of how the world changes and forces changes in business. And people who can't do that are the ones who fail, it seems to me. They can't make that transition from what they thought they had to do to what they actually have to do if they're going to adapt to the change. So can you train someone to adapt to change who isn't naturally doing that?
So that's same nature nurture leadership thing, right? Yeah, that, and I've never heard anybody able to explain which one has precedent, you know, which one's correct. So, and obviously the entire leadership training industry would go away if it was just nature, because then you couldn't do anything about it. And I think the same thing applies to being an entrepreneur or business owner, business leader, especially in small businesses. You can teach people tenacity, but you have to know how to teach tenacity for it to stick. It's the same thing as teaching a child to be comfortable, you know, climbing a height or something. And they have to understand what they're doing. They have to trust what you're saying, and they have to take it little steps until they've achieved it. And then it's no longer the risk they perceive. So it diminishes in their mind, and then they've achieved it completely. And they'll climb that little hill, or whatever it is. They'll swim in the pool, whatever it was that was the objective that you were trying to help them overcome. And eventually, if you think about it with kids, we do that with all kinds of things. And then at some point, when they're about 11 or 12, we stop coaching them through physical adversity and mental adversity. And we kind of just turn them over to the school to teach them things, you know, out of books. But that's, it is teachable. It's not something that just has to be, you have to be born with. It's just difficult for people to understand that it's teachable. And usually by the time you're an entrepreneur, you're already an adult. So the last time somebody taught you that it was okay to get in the pool, or it was okay to put your foot in the ocean, it wasn't going to kill you or anything, was a long time ago. That risk-taking, learning risk-taking, recovering and understanding risk, that cycle is like maybe a decade plus old by the time they're in business.
Okay, so somehow you have to be exposed to risk-taking early in your life in order to even decide to be an entrepreneur?
It helps, I think. In the SEALs, they've done all kinds of psychological studies. Kids of divorced families have had to create coping mechanisms, survival mechanisms that are based on themselves and a self-worth and self-confidence and an understanding they can't control the external world and forces are gonna blow them left and right, but they've got a sense of themselves and they're still gonna go forward. And when they show up in a course like a SEAL training course, they thrive because they've got all these kind of prerequisites already psychologically. It's the exact opposite. Sometimes we get people that were from very good standard nuclear homes, mother, father. If they fell, they were picked up. If they needed money, they were handed some money. But maybe they're great physical specimens, great athletes. They show up in there and they've never really had adversity. You know, they weren't challenged. They didn't take risks. They were protected. And I don't mean coddled protected, but they were kind of in a cocoon of safety and security. And then they go to join a profession that's anything but safety and security. and they pass all the physical screening tests, they get into the course, and then they fail psychologically. So if that's the prerequisite, I don't think you have to be a child going through divorce to become resilient because of divorce. You can do that as an adult or any other psychological challenge that you have to face and overcome. It's kind of hard to impose in a training environment the level of emotional impact, the psychological impact of a divorce as part of a training.
Right. And it's not just divorce that makes people stronger. It's whatever you had to overcome as a child, where you weren't coddled and where you had to find a pathway on your own. But also it seems to me that courage, that there's a inborn thing called courage that some people have and some people don't have. When I was getting my pilot's license and I got through the soloing part where I had to face my death on the tarmac when I was sitting there deciding whether to fly or die, and I talked to a lot of men afterwards who said, oh, I took flying lessons, but I couldn't do the solo. And to me, that seems like something inborn, but you're saying, if I get you correctly, that when you've had to make certain decisions in your younger years, that will make a difference.
It will. And I think even when you're older, a lot of serial entrepreneurs are serial entrepreneurs because they tried again after failing the first time. If they failed more than once or twice, they start to build up that same kind of scar tissue resilience, kind of trust in themselves and their own drive and their own sense of self-worth, confidence. And they also let themselves off the hook a little bit, you know, about perfection and execution. People fail in business. People fail in lots of things. It's a part of life. It's a part of nature. It's evolutionary, if you think of it that way, in a positive way. So learn from it, get stronger, move forward. That can be taught and that can be pointed out and illustrated and demonstrated, I think, at any age, as long as it's crafted correctly, you know, towards the goal or the objective of whatever you're trying to accomplish.
So it surprised me that you went into the financial business industry after you left the Navy. And I wonder what drove you in that direction.
There's probably two different things. Originally, I wanted to be a lawyer, and I took the LSAT just before I retired. And then I had a lunch with another SEAL that had retired, who was working for a large securities firm, Alex Brown at the time, in Baltimore. So he pointed out that I had a master's degree. Why do you want to go to school for another 3 years? And why do you want to be a lawyer? And I said, well, I kind of want to run my own show, set up my own shop, kind of just work with the clients that I want to work with. And you can do that as a lawyer. And he said, well, you can do that as a financial advisor too. So he, in the course of a lunch, talked me out of what I'd been preparing for like 5 months. And so I started interviewing and then joined that. I think the shock though, and I liked stocks. I liked the idea of investing. I had a little bit of, not that much money, I had a little bit of money, and I thought I was quite the stock guy, and I thought, okay, I can do this. It'll be fun. And then I show up and, you know, after I do the training, which was 4 months, your training salary goes away. You're on pure commission and fees. And that's when I found out that I wasn't going to be issued any clients. I was told, no, you got to go out and find them. And that's when I never heard of some of these terms, because they don't teach sales in either, you know, an undergrad business course or your MBA, MBA programs. I had to look up things like what cold walking was and cold calling and all kinds of crazy stuff. And I learned from scratch, and I was freaking out because I had little kids, and I thought, oh boy, I made a huge mistake. And this isn't like, I'm not even picking stocks because I don't have any clients. You know, so I had to learn how to sell and sell conceptually from scratch, trying everything. Eventually, seminars is what worked. I was good in front of people. People trusted me, even though I looked like I was 12 years old. And that kind of got me on the road. And then I realized that the analytics side of the business was tedious and very math intensive and things. And what I really liked was being the problem solver, the quarterback for people's financial situations and help them kind of reorder it and square it away and align it with their goals, set up a strategy and all that. It was more of a coaching kind of a thing and a mentoring kind of a thing. And that's what really what my practice ended up being. That's what that attracted referrals and money, because that was my style. And that kind of eventually looped back to my strengths that I had in SEAL teams as an officer. So in a weird way, I got out to do something totally different and end up leveraging something exactly the same.
So that's twice where something showed up that you didn't expect that turned out to be how you were going to spend 20 years.
Yeah, you're scaring me, man. You think there's like some kind of spooky thing going on here?
Oh, no. I call it synchronicity. I think that everything that shows up, everyone who shows up and is what you need to become who you're becoming, but you don't know who you're becoming. And whatever that is that guides our lives, and there's no way to describe that on a logical way, things show up and they turn out to be what we need if we're willing to go along with this flow of life that seems to be one of your abilities as well, is to go with the flow of life. That there's, you're missing that resistance to the unknown and change.
Yeah, and my wife would agree with you on the synchronicity piece. She doesn't understand it, but she's been a witness to it for a long time. It's kind of like making your own future by just being open to what the future might bring to you, and which is kind of the same thing you were just saying. The flow thing is interesting because, you know, if you jump into a big river, you may bang around and go to the left side of the river, the right side of the river, and eventually you end up at a destination. It might be a waterfall, and then you end up in a pond. It's the same medium. It's water. And it's taking through all kinds of different environments and different experiences and different locations and different experiences of that particular type of medium. And when you look back, none of those experiences are exactly the same, but they're all connected by that flow of that water. And that's kind of how I see all this. If I like to help people and I like to coach and I like to learn and I'm open-minded and I'm not concerned about failure, whether through nurturing or training or just exposure to failure and recovery, that opens me up to all kinds of places to flow on the river. I'm not trying to purposely swim to the shore and grab onto a tree and get the heck out of the environment. You know, that's not what I'm doing.
Okay. So
that's a heck of a metaphor.
It is, particularly if you don't like to swim. So how did all that experience bring you to where you are today as a CEO of an organization?
I think it would be the same type of consistent theme of being an open, objective, glass completely full and overflowing kind of point of view of life and business, which allows me to be the optimist in the room, even in the worst of situations. And when senior people are running a business or a corporation or a project and things aren't going well, and there's one person looking at him saying, I'll go through this with you. I'll jump in the fire with you. Hey, we'll work it out. It may not be perfect, but we're going to come out the other side and it's going to be better than it is right now. That's attractive to senior leaders who have a lot a lot at risk at the time. And so whether it was in the Navy or, you know, not so much in managing money, but later when I started getting into corporations, that was recognized. Those attributes were recognized. I was calm, I was poised, and I was enthusiastic and optimistic, but I wasn't an idiot. I wasn't doing it because I was clueless as to what I was being exposed to. And then I would roll my sleeves up, regardless of my rank or positional authority, and try to fix, try to help, try to assist. And I was willing to be readjusted and moved around. So over time, I'd end up being kind of a fixer. I'd be put places that were falling apart. I'd get them up to speed and working. And then they'd put me someplace else, kind of like a little firefighter, which helped me expand my horizons and my bandwidth and my aperture, because I realized I have a skill that isn't super technically focused or contained. So I was an instrument rated pilot, but that was way after I was somebody trying to help a big aviation component of a company. At that time, I wasn't a pilot and I didn't know anything about cargo planes. But what I was helping them with wasn't about the planes. It was about the structure of the people and how they were solving problems. And that gave me another kind of layer of experience that I have something to offer. You know, I can come in and help with the fight and do what I can do until I'm no longer useful because we've solved the problem, let's say. And then I'm standing by ready to help with something else. And that's always made me kind of a utility player. And eventually the scope and scale of what I was put in charge of got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's kind of how that evolved.
And the thing you said that I found interesting was you said, and I wasn't afraid of failure.
No. I'm a child of a divorced family. So I fit that profile I was talking about before. There were guys in SEAL training that were afraid that if they quit, their dad would hate them. And that's why they got through. I mean, there was a fear driving it, you know. I didn't have that. I just didn't want to quit. And I made a decision when I was 13 after a divorce that if nobody else is really going to pay attention or care about my well-being or my future, it's either going to be me taking care of myself or I'm just going to drift. So I decided I was going to take care of myself. So even at 17, when I walked in there, I had 4 solid years of working multiple jobs, buying my own car, Marty taking care of Marty. And so I felt like, you know, the challenges of the SEAL course wasn't devastating.
I mean, you're telling a story that goes with what I believe, which is whatever you go through is what you need to become who you're becoming. And, you know, people think they've been through trouble, like a divorce, a parent's divorcing, which on the adverse child experience test counts as one of those things that's going to screw you up. And it still seems to me that there's something inborn with people like you who just have this ability. It's like not fear of failure, not da-da-da-da. You have a number of things that have come together to allow you to be who you are today. But those things were not all taught or all responses to your upbringing. That there's something inborn. I mean, now they're studying behavioral genetics and what we, and you had someone in the service who was in your family, which is often the case. And so I'm finding it fascinating that you said to yourself, I'm going to take care of myself. And there are so many people in today's world who have these chronic diseases because they're not willing to take care of themselves. And to me, the question is, how do you convince someone that they can take care of themselves and that they don't have to feel like the world is taking advantage of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there is some truth to an innate, whether it's genetic or it's the same experiment. You'll see kids of a divorced family, there's 4 kids, and 2 of them will become extremely successful, resilient, strong adults that can punch through any problem. And the other 2 become alcoholics and they get divorced 15 times, you know, but they were in the same environment, let's say. And you're like, scratch your head and go, how did that happen? I mean, the same, test experiment, the same environment. Was it an outside influence that nobody saw? You know, was it a priest, a rabbi, a teacher that influenced, you know, the 2 strong ones? Or was it somebody that influenced the 2 weak ones in a way that made them feel like they could never take care of themselves and their future, so they just gave up? I don't know, but I do know that most behaviors repeated tend to be repeated as behaviors, right? So if you practice resilient attitudes and resilience as a behavior, if you accept failure, you don't have to like it. Nobody likes to fail. I mean, I don't like to fail, but I accept it. And as a CEO, you know what it's like in a room? when everybody tried really hard at something that was kind of on the edge of the possible, and they got 80% of the way there. In one scenario, a CEO comes in and calls everybody a failure and says, you guys blew this, and you told me this was gonna work. And I come in and say, all right, so we get 80% there. How do we get the rest of the way? Can we get 10%? Is 80% good enough? Is anybody else doing this at any percentage? Let's lay it out there and do kind of a real life prototyping and fix it as we go. You know, there are different ways to handle different kinds of failure, and you can reinforce the negative of the failure. You can just take it as a lesson learned and move on, or you can take it and say, it's a step towards success. Let's see what we can do next to keep evolving this. And that's an attitude.
Yes. And it's like at one point in my life, I mean, I'm 80 years old, so I've had a long time to look at life. At one point in my life, I had two millionaire brothers and I couldn't rub two pennies together. And I asked myself that question of why. Why we were brought up in the same home. They were boys and I was the girl, and there was a very different attitude towards girls in the family than boys. And I just looked at it and I asked the why question. Why is this true? And that led me to ask the question of how do we create our life stories? Why does one person succeed and another one fail when they come from the same family? And that's been my lifelong journey of looking for the answer to that question, which is why I love to talk to people like you who have such a different life than I could have had in a million years. And I'm fascinated by how you became who you became, you know, and yeah. And you're not done yet. You've got years left, and it's like you can't lose because you have such a positive attitude and you're looking for answers. You're not looking to blame people. You know, I mean, you're taking responsibility for your life.
Yeah. When I sat down to write Be Nimble, one of the questions, and I looked at a lot of books about how to write business leadership books, et cetera. And one of the things was express your bona fides, express why you are the person anybody should listen to in a book. You know, and I was faced with answering these questions you've been asking me, you know, what makes me the person to write this book? What makes me the person for somebody to feel like they should read what I wrote in this book? What created me? What's the sum total of all my experiences that kind of came together and culminated in the person that's sitting here and has the audacity to think somebody else cares about their opinion? It was really hard. I mean, it was almost like I'm trying to start a memoir or something, right. But I thought it was important as an introduction that they at least know who I am, because I couldn't say, I'm a Harvard MBA and I ran Disney for 15 years as the CEO. Well, enough said, let's move on to chapter one, right? I couldn't put that in there. And I don't know if I got it all right. I don't know if I really completely covered all the different inputs and influences, and hell, it's still happening. I get influenced all the time, every day. It's a work in progress. But the fear of failure is, it's a real human emotion, and it causes a lot of psychological and physiological stress. There's measurable physiological problems when people are afraid. And for example, I've got somebody who owns a skydiving training facility, and he sends me a text this morning and we're going to meet for coffee. Well, then it all got all messed up. And then he said, well, why don't you come in at 9 o'clock Monday on Memorial Day, and I'll on the house, I'll let you go ahead and fly in the chamber. So it's skydive training. I have over 750 skydives. I didn't skydive after I left the service. That was 25 years ago. I'm looking at this text and all I'm thinking about is I'm going to look like an idiot bouncing off the walls in there. Cause I mean, I was thinking about how bad I was going to fail, and I've got 750 jumps. You know, that's just the way my head works, like everybody else. And then I have to calm myself down and say, okay, what's the worst thing? You know, it's not like you're going to have Good Morning America filming it or something. And so then, you know, I kind of calm down, but yeah, I'm human. Everybody has the same initial reaction. It's kind of how you deal with the second reaction.
And I love that question, what's the worst that can happen?
Yeah.
I mean, I deal with a lot of people with financial issues. And financial fear, I don't care how successful a person is, they've got financial fear. And one of the things I talk about is how to overcome that. And one of the main questions is, what's the worst that can happen? Because
you spent a lot of your career, though, talking about people's relationship with money. Because I looked through your background and, you know, 7 years, I could say that I help people make money, but I could also say I spent most of my time holding hands as a therapist, trying to get them to calm down about their money. I used to use the stock chart. I'd show people stock chart on a whiteboard. And I said, okay, what do you think this is? And they said, well, it looks like you've drawn like a stock chart. I said, I have. You know what else it is? It's an EKG. This is your heart rate, you know? And there used to be a joke that, according to the media that's covering, whether print or TV media covering the stock market, there's only two directions. It's like an elevator with only two buttons, plunge and soar. and that's how people would react. So yeah, you spend a lot of time when you're talking about money with people, and just because they have a lot of money doesn't mean they're that much, you know, tougher about it or savvy.
Or happy.
And then if you get two partners in the room, and you know, one's aggressive and the other one's extremely passive, or one believes that the money should be in a mattress and the other one believes it should be in a, you know, a penny stock, and you're going, like, looking back and forth going, okay guys, you know, I assume this isn't going to be a joint account. You can't reconcile your attitudes towards risk, let alone money.
Right.
Yeah. And that was a learning. That was a lot of learning about human nature. You know, that wasn't the intent of 7 years in that business, but man, I learned a lot.
And to me, this is what fascinates me, is the emotions that people bring to their money, because it's never about money. It's always about their previous life experiences. And
yeah,
I was talking to someone yesterday, and what I've been looking at is the feelings that go with up and down income. And most entrepreneurs understand up and down income. What you're doing today is not, it's that stock chart, you know, and there's no such thing as, I haven't seen many stock charts where it starts down here and it goes all the way up. There's these little breaks along the way. So I've asked, okay, when you're in a down, what is the value of that down? And I think it allows you to look at your life from a different perspective. Once you realize that just because it's down doesn't mean it's a failure. It's just a down. And what is the advantage for you in being in that pause, which is something we've all just gone through with COVID, where the world took a pause. And I think these pauses are fabulous because it's a time of reflection.
Yeah, that stock chart is only a measured depiction of an evolutionary flow. It's all evolutionary. And, you know, some things can be de-evolutionary to the point where they don't exist anymore, but most things aren't. And most things aren't linear in their evolution. You know, two steps back, one step to the left, and then five steps forward. And again, if you have an open mind, and you have a little bit of faith that you can handle what you bump into, it's okay that you take kind of a wiggle worm path towards whatever's out there. Some people don't believe in that. I think there's a lot of linear logic taught by society and in schools, and a lot of parents. You know, the old, you know, you do this, you do this, you do this, you get this. So whether it's school to a job, you know, you get prestige and respect if you get a degree or whatever it is. And that's really a false promise. That's not the world out there at all. I mean, I used to teach this thing called nonlinear success strategies to a nonprofit with single mothers, and we were trying to teach them how to, you know, create resumes, get through interviews, get jobs and things. And I taught this component, and everybody thought, and I was managing money at the time, and the single mothers in the room assumed that I was going to tell them that story. You know, here's a guy in a $500 suit. So he's going to say, you know, I had two parents and they put me through college and I went to Yale and I, you know, And I started telling my story, and they're like, what? And I was all over the place, you know, to get to that point when I was standing in front of them. As I taught the course later, I thought, well, rather than just talking about myself, I used President Grant, this is Grant's life, and Truman, because both of them became presidents, and both of them became technically famous, the way Americans look at that, whatever fame is. But if you look at their lives, they failed, they were bankrupt, you know, they failed in lots of ways. Grant failed in the Army, he was a success in the Army, and then he failed, and he kind of got kicked out, you know, under accusations of being a drunk, and then the war starts, he tries to get in, nobody wants him, and then he ends up being in command of the entire Union Army, and then President of the United States. So I would tell that story to them, you know, and then maybe I'd throw in a little bit of mine so they realize that that linear thing is why you don't think you can do this. You think it's fixed. You think that that's the only way. There's a railroad track to success. If I fell off, it's over. If I was never put on the railroad track by my parents, whatever, it's over. And that's not true in any component of life.
And as we start to close down here, I think that what you've given us is a way of looking at things. It's interesting because you and I are really different. And what, although we have some similarity in interests, like with the money stuff, and you're extremely curious and are willing to try new things. And so our internal worlds are not that different, but our external worlds are very different. And I think that people, for me, don't always take the time to find out who they are and what works for them. And they're spending their lives doing that linear thing with, I'll do this and that and this and that, and I'm going to wind up with that, and it doesn't work. And, you know, you've done a lot of self-exploration in your life, and you obviously have a very good logical mind, and you're able to make good decisions, and, you know, that's your talent. And some people have it, some people don't. And so I've really enjoyed our conversation. If people want to learn more about you and get notified when your book comes out, how can they get in touch with you?
They can go to www.martystrongbnimble.com. And the book is also available for pre-sale on amazon.com. And there's a link on my website.
And were you born with the last name Strong, or is that one that you adopted?
I was born with the, I thought I was Irish until my kids bought me 23andMe 4 years ago, and I found out I'm actually Scandinavian and French.
But being brought up with the name Strong, it's like it gave you an identity in a way that a lot of people don't get.
Yeah, the kid named Strong in the football team that only weighed 100 pounds. And, yeah. the SEAL student named Strong, it looked like he was 12 years old and only weighed 125. Oh, yeah, they played with me a lot. They had me try to lift cars by myself. There's all kinds of, you know. You don't want to have a funny name or a weird name or a verb or anything like that if you're going through SEAL training, because the instructors are bored and they'll figure something out.
Yeah. The name Sotkin, we're the only Sotkins in the whole country. Anyone with the name Sotkin in America is a relative on some level. And it's weird being the only one. I'm the only Joan Sotkin in the whole world. And That gives me a sense of myself that I couldn't get if there were dozens of Joan Sotkins. So it's kind of interesting. All right, well, Marty, I really enjoyed meeting you and talking to you. And I hope we get to meet along the way. And I want to thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John. This has been fun. This and the pre-call was fun, too.
Okay, yes. All right, well, have a good time.
All
bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
What really fascinates me is how different we all are, and yet how there are similarities as well. And to me, that's the key to success, is being able to find similarities. Our brains are wired to see the differences, but it seems to me when we can find the similarities and allows us to feel more connected to other people. And to me, that's what we really have to do in order to be satisfied people, is to feel connected. When you feel alone and disconnected, that's not a very pleasant state of being. But when you can feel connected and satisfied and learn some of the things that Marty talked about, I think you can have a much more successful life. So that's it for today. I really thank you for being here. Someone reminded me that I should say something about writing a review on iTunes. So if you feel the urge to do that, I would really appreciate it. And if you want to talk to me about how you can develop some of these inner skills that lead to success, then get in touch with me. You can always get in touch with me by going to prosperityplace.com/call and setting up a time to talk to me. I'm really easy to talk to. So as I said, that's it for today. I really appreciate your being here, and I look forward to interacting with you next time. Bye now.